All right. Well, now that we got that out of our system.
Yeah, I briefly considered beginning this by reading Slouching Towards Bethlehem, which is obviously not the name of that poem, but...
why aren't we doing that?
I was too lazy to look up the text of it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is
The Office Hour.
Good evening, Toby.
Good evening,
this is a
Andrew.
Special evening edition of The Office Hour.
Although they all used to be.
They all editions. Used to be. It's just that this is the first one of 2017 that we're recording in the evening. And we have a special guest today, Dr. Ruthie Yao, who is, like Toby and I, a Britain fellow at Georgia Tech. Welcome to the podcast, Ruthie.
Thanks, gentlemen.
So today's topic is protest. That's what we're going to be talking about today. It's a thing that's been happening a lot in the world recently. Ruthie, if you don't mind my saying so, I think that protest might have something to do with your research. Is that true? Did I hear that correctly? Or read about it online correctly?
For sure. My research is engaged with protest in as much as any social reform that has ever come about in our country is a product of protest. It's unregistered. I work on schools, and I work on the successes and the failures of our national project to integrate our schools. Protests were a part of that. Many of those protests, particularly the ones that were student-led, aren't part of our conversation, which is unfortunate, because that's a really powerful legacy, not just for us as historians to excavate and write articles about that no one will read, but I know, boo-hoo, but for our students today to know about. So yeah, a lot of the work that I do features courts and teachers and lawyers and school board members, but I think that the work that I love the most and the work that's valuable is the work about students in communities who figured out the connection between community building, protest action, and the integration of the community in the school, which is an ongoing journey in American communities everywhere, not just in the South. So yeah, I'm totally interested in protest, and I'm totally interested in schools, but I'm also into whether or not we have a new sort of way of thinking about protest today because of our particular political moment.
Well, I mean, that sort of is where I was thinking we could kind of start. So I was at the recent protest. You were there also, Ruthie, at the Atlanta airport on Sunday evening. And I was talking with a friend afterwards, after that protest. I was protesting the executive order that, you know, dare I say, President Trump put out on Saturday, last Saturday. And this friend of mine was sort of, like, asking me, you know, like, what can protesting actually do, right? She brought up the fact that you watch television news whenever they are covering places like Syria or Turkey or, you know, Lebanon. Mideast, but throughout the world, there are people that are protesting constantly, right? And yet, bad things continue to happen to them. Right? And I think for a long time, the answer to that question, from my perspective, would have been like, well, you know, we live in the United States, which is based on a political structure in which the people communicating frustration to the government, you know, is at least ostensibly going to change something, maybe. But, you know, that may be changing in the current political climate, but I am interested in hearing from you, Ruthie, and you can chime in with this as well, Toby. Like, what do you think the, like, actual point of protesting is?
I hate and love that question. I think often it's the question that you ask yourself.
Right.
When it's, like, really cold and you'd rather have a burrito than, like, go hold a sign.
Yeah, she mostly just hates that question.
Right.
I adore that question. But I think that it's the question that we need to hold ourselves responsible for and to. Certainly my students ask that question and they need to talk about that question fruitfully. Today we did Freedom Summer. That was we're working on SNCC and student struggle. And we talked about why white students, and these are different, right? We're talking about investing in a movement and we're talking about going to a protest. But they're not,
right.
They're not separate endeavors entirely, right? You have to imagine that there is possibility for movement building if you are going to go to a protest. Or that's what the sociology has shown, right? And the kids, mostly white kids, mostly like elite, you know, Cornell, Dartmouth, Brown educated kids who went south in 1964, mostly white men. Good job, guys. they uniformly said that the reason that they were involved, and then there's, you know, all the sub-reasons which are less interesting, pre-existing ties to an organization, religious reasons, political orientation, but the reason was efficacy, that they felt that they had the power to make a difference. And I think that that's actually what protesting is. It's in the, like, creepy, you know, bullshit, no-knowledge literature of our popular moment, it's self-work.
Right.
Your process of civic enfranchisement, metaphorically, right? Or in the case of Freedom Summer, literally. And those college kids were interested in sort of the Mississippi as the proving ground of their power, you know? I mean, they also were altruistic, courageous kids, right? The third week of Freedom Summer, three of them were murdered, and they kept on coming. So it's certainly a story about altruism, but it's also about the way that you understand your own presence to have potentially material impact on your life or the lives of others you know and care about. So, I think that that's, you know, maybe this is a cynical answer, but it's the one that the sociology suggests is maybe right, that protesting is about the protester, in many cases.
For me, the way that I'm able to get myself to go do it, right, is that, like, I will be one more person there, right?
Yeah.
So when they, you know, take a picture of the Washington Mall to show how many people there, how many people not there, like, my being there will be, you know, one more person. Like, to me, like, it's a similar thing to voting. Right? But I think that framing it the way that you did in terms of it being kind of about oneself is really interesting. And I don't think that those two ideas that it's about yourself or it's about being a part of like a larger body or something like that are at all like contradictory with each other either.
And I think too, it's about the action. It's how you frame your action in the context of your group affiliation, and in the context of that particular moment, which is produced through 1,000 lenses, right? Whether it be Twitter or CNN or... I mean, Toby, your question, when you were feeding me a question
I've been waiting carefully to ask this very question. Man, perfect timing. So, and I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I think this conversation has been more interesting than this question will necessarily make it. But so what is the difference between a protest, a riot, a movement, and, you know, I don't know, like a rally or something like this? Is that as bare bones as it sounds like a riot is people who don't have much power essentially being assaulted by the police or breaking some things, and a protest is a bunch of people who have power having the self-realization movement, and is a movement a different thing, like, or is this just sort of semantic people trying to find different words to talk about the same stuff in the news cycle?
Where did you come down on it all?
I'm not completely sure. I mean, and I guess part of this is not so much a confusion about semantics as it is I've been sort of, I don't know, what feels like rolling around on the floor, kind of staring at the wall. Like, in a sort of intellectual way, I feel like, okay, so sure, Congress is compromised. Sure, the courts are compromised. Sure, the executive branch is compromised. Sure, law enforcement is compromised. In all these different ways. And there's a part of the intellectual is like, well, of course, then popular protest is necessarily the thing. You know, like, what if the Republicans get swept out of office in 2018? Like, what are the ways that large movements of people exerting a kind of popular influence works? But I don't know. Because I think there's somebody standing, you know, on the other side of the mirror being like, thank God that the Tea Party movement did this. And then it's, is it just like bizarro Toby wearing a red hat, like, will equally weigh against me?
Well, this is something I've been thinking about, too, especially in light of the recent efforts for people calling their senators to block, or not even their senators, but other senators to block Trump's cabinet appointments. You know, this is a cynical point of view, but for me, it's hard to believe that any representatives, especially Republican representatives, but also Democratic representatives, too, unless they're imminently up for re-election, it's hard to believe that any of them at this point really care about what their constituents think at all. And so for me, I feel like one of the positive possibilities of protest, as opposed to retaining a belief in, like, representation, is that protest can also be a kind of way of shaming the government, right? Like, a big, like, this can clearly be seen in Trump kind of, you know, denying the amount of people at the Women's March being more than at his inauguration. Like, the fact that there are so many people around the world protesting him is, like, not only showing that there are a lot of people that don't like his policies, etc., but that, like, it's in fact embarrassing for the government, both domestically and internationally, that there are so many people that are so upset about this, right? And I found, like, even though shame was not a, like, successful tactic in bringing Trump down during the election, I do think, though, that the moments in which he was shamed were, you know, more successful in lessening his support than the other strategies that either his opponents or whomever used to kind of attack him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I don't know. It's making me think about several years ago. I was involved in a series of student protests at University of California, Davis, that culminated in a police officer pepper spraying a bunch of my colleagues and students. And
wow.
Yeah. Remember there was a meme that.
Yeah. No, that was really famous. I forgot that happened at Davis.
And so there was this big thing. Turned out this woman, Chancellor Katehi, had been the one who had, like, ordered, non-ordered, sort of sent police with militarized weaponry in to clear out students because she didn't like the form of their protest.
In the Occupy era? This.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Toby, that's so cool.
I wasn't there, but, I mean, I had been there, you know, earlier that day.
Right, sorry, go ahead.
And then there was, like, this whole thing, you know, like, the faculty did, like, a vote of confidence, which she narrowly won, and then she just stayed in her position. And it wasn't until last year that another scandal came up where it turned out she was moonlighting with a corporate job, making, like, another $400,000 on the side while still being chancellor of the school, that she was finally outed by the administration. And it was, like, there was all that protest. There was the boldest incompetency and direct violence towards the students. And we couldn't even muster like a faculty no confidence vote, you know?
Yeah.
And ultimately the thing that brought her down was just like administrative corruption. And so like, and the thing that we were protesting, which was like massive tuition hikes, happened anyway.
Right.
So, I don't know. This is not to say I don't think there's a point to protesting. It's just like...
You just don't think there's a point unless you're a player on a college football team.
Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know.
Because clearly if you're on an NFL football team, then it doesn't matter at all.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious, Ruthie, like, in the, you know, not only thinking about the protests that have happened in, you know, the weeks, the months since Trump's election, but in thinking about the last couple of years, the development of Black Lives Matter, things like that, I'm curious to hear, you know, as someone with a certain kind of historical expertise about protesting, what is heartening about the kind of contemporary protest movement in America? What, if anything, is disheartening about it? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think, as a white woman, I don't think I know or understand or can fully comprehend the vitality of the Black Lives Matter movement. I think that it is part and parcel of the long freedom struggle, which has never fully perished despite the efforts of, you know, Reagan.
Yeah, or Jeff Sessions, just to pick a name.
Yeah, just to pluck one out of the sky. Or Bush, or Clinton, for that matter. But I think what we are searching for in protest, we find when the enemy is elucidated in terms and in images that no one can redeem, right?
Yeah.
My students were talking about, without realizing they were, you know, citing some trend in this historiography, but we're talking about what civil rights historians refer to as the backlash thesis. And historians of social movements generally. And of course, we can imagine that if there had not been fire hoses and dogs, or cameras for that matter, then maybe there would have been no Civil Rights Act.
Or
Voting Rights Act. The students are more familiar with
Right, this
Sunday
is like
because of Selma.
The famous slave image at the beginning of the Civil War of the man with his back, like, torn to shreds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Or the images that circulated when Britain outlawed the slave trade. So I think what we encounter when we are asked to assess the vitality or place in historical continuum protest movements right now is what we understand to be a common and engageable enemy. And I think that the Occupy movement and the Black Lives Matter movement are similarly engaged with structural inequality that hasn't a human face. And so when we, or for me, as a white educator and scholar, I'm unsure about what it is I am to look for in Black Lives Matter. I think that that's my answer in and of itself, that my lack of purchase is probably a good sign in some ways. And that grassroots movements that have local integrity and coherence don't need to be legible to historians in the moment. And I think, too, I mean, Toby, what you said about the Tea Party, about sort of a kind of cynicism around protest in this moment, it's interesting to look at the late 60s through the same lens.
Mm-hmm.
And this engages the question of a protest and a demonstration and an uprising and a riot. Grace Lee Boggs, famous organizer who lived in Detroit for 60 years and died at 102 years ago. She was married to a civil rights organizer and a Black Power activist, Jimmy Boggs. And she said that the Detroit uprisings were a powerful turning point for Detroit. And no one, I think at first, and her immediate audience knew quite what she meant, but she meant the Detroit riots in 67. Some of the most destructive riots of the 20th century, basically, urban riots. And she insisted that an uprising is the moment at which people come together, not necessarily seeking to deliver a 10-point plan, but seeking to claim territory through which some new order might be built. And I think that some of the same observations or insights might be made about what we see as the local organizing produced through Black Lives Matter or produced through this past weekend's and last weekend's demonstrations across the country, that these are moments consistent with, though not yet legible as, uprisings on a continuum.
Well, I have a question then about this kind of uprising thing. So I do really like that term. And I guess this question kind of dovetails with something that I've seen a little bit of in social media, which is, I guess, the compatibility of the various movements that are being sort of lumped under the umbrella term of progressivism. So
yeah.
like the Women's March in opposition to like Black Lives Matter,
right.
in opposition to like democratic socialists, in opposition to the Occupy movement, in opposition to,
sure.
I mean, the sort of Hollywood elites, you know, students, Screen Actors Guild type of kind of protest speech. Are these things compatible in the way of being an uprising, or are these all just like sort of singular progressive threads that don't really touch one another and all are just sort of antithetical to Trump? Or is that like as impossible a question as maybe it sounds like?
No, I mean, I think that's a great question. I think this is like not at all an answer, but it's like maybe could loop around and transform into something. One of the observations that sociologist I mentioned earlier, Doug McAdam, writes about is that students who were participating in Freedom Summer in 64 showcased ideological diversity. And the point that he's making is that they, like, and I found this to be so fascinating because I'm not a sociologist, and these are, when it comes down to it, less interesting rubrics for me. But he's offering that ideological diversity meant essentially that the New Left hadn't emerged yet as a coherent set of ideas which required adherence, right? And mm-hmm. and that if you were a student activist in 68, there were political ideas that if you weren't subscribing to, you had a clearly articulated defense of your slight divergence from what was dogma by then, right? On the left. So he's pointing out that these kids who are coming to Mississippi are saying stuff like, I'm coming to Mississippi. They're not radical kids. I'm coming to Mississippi to honor the legacy of JFK. I'm coming to Mississippi to improve, this is McAdams quoting this from an application, to improve the standing of the U.S. in the world and fight communism. So I think, I mean, again, this isn't an answer.
I like that. Ah, man.
but I think, like, who knows what will be codified as the credo, right?
Yeah.
A coherent credo of the given moment until later. I mean, this is my historian's cheap way out, right? Like, I don't know, because it's not like long ago yet.
Yeah, the Condoleezza Rice episode. History will judge us.
will it?
This gets at a question I had about what you were talking about earlier, about things becoming legible. I mean, what ultimately, aside from just time passing, right, what makes a movement or a protest or an uprising, what makes it legible?
I think that victory makes it legible.
Boom.
Right? And that's what makes this question of Black Lives Matter and Occupy so tragic.
Right?
Tragic now, you know, maybe ironic or the product of gloating in 15 years or 40. But we don't know how dismissed the activists would have been in Woolville, Mississippi, if we hadn't had the victory of the Voting Rights Act. Consistent victories at the federal and state levels, you know, in the decades following. And we wouldn't even know how to reimagine a powerful protest movement if there hadn't been so much retrenchment. And I think that's what I think, as a historian of social movements, I'm fundamentally interested in fluidity and the way that what we understand to be a given formation with legs, right, sturdy, has sort of, like I said, is legible in terms of the state and in terms of the populace and in terms of elected mm-hmm. officials, right? We can see it as a formation that had efficacy in its given moment, that those are not rubrics that are salient to us until they become so. So through victory.
Sure, and I think this is interesting in light of the protests having to do with the president at the moment. I mean, clearly the protests at the airport had this last weekend, or at various airports around the world, had a very clear target, right? And it was this executive order that Trump made.
Yeah.
And the Voting Rights Act, that, I mean, that can historically be seen as a victory because there's a very sort of coherent message behind the protest leading up to that, right?
Right.
Whereas something like, you know, the protests against the Vietnam War are perhaps a little bit murkier, right? Because, you know, the war did end, but it did not end in the way that a lot of people wanted it to. And so the sort of victory of that movement is a little perhaps less legible than something like SOMA, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm wondering what kind of commentary you might have about current protest actions against the president. Is there anything that we should be doing in terms of, you know, tightening up the message of our protests or targeting it more specifically or anything like that? Or do you think, you know, a more kind of diffuse approach to protesting the current political situation has the same kind of potential as something much more specific or direct?
Well, I mean, that's such a great question. And I think that you're giving the example of protests that are direct, at least in their what they seek to underscore, right? As some inhuman, if we're talking about Trump, of course, some inhuman and profoundly ignorant infringement on our democratic ideals. But I think in the, like, broad scheme, and I feel bad that I would talk about winning.
Right.
It sounds so Trumpy.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But I guess what I would say is that winning is then determined by the community, and that we would return our protest aims and actions to the community. So, like, I thought the best chant last night, on Sunday, was Make Atlanta a Sanctuary City. Well, why aren't we a sanctuary city?
Absolutely.
That's really material. That's something that actually a bunch of us with positions at institutions in the system have some power over. So I think figuring out what targets exist and approaching those strategically, that not only is, I think, effective protesting, but that's movement building. In order to do that successfully, you and I would have to activate all of our disparate networks and try to imagine how our imagined aligned goals across our social groups and intellectual groups, how those goals could produce something really, really clearly wonderful, like a sanctuary city.
And I mean, that also introduces the possibility of a protest as an actual, like, that is like kind of a venue, a process for developing a kind of program.
Absolutely.
Right? Like,
absolutely.
Like maybe that's how these directives get figured out, is in the moment through a chant or something like that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the question then becomes interrupted and complicated by the social media thing.
Surely.
That both builds and diffuses activism and activist networks through Gladwell's thesis, right? About strong and weak tie activism. But yeah, I mean, I heard, like, over the megaphone, basically what you just said, a bunch of ideas about what to do next. And that's pretty powerful.
Absolutely.
And that's, for me, that's reason enough. I mean, like, the burrito in my robe is here.
Uh-huh.
And, like, hearing Ideas for Social Change is here, and it's like, but that was awesome.
It took me a second to get the burrito thing, but I'm caught back up now.
Yeah. I think we came full circle. Well, listen, guys, I think we're out of time for today, but this has been a beautiful conversation. Thank you so much for coming on, Ruthie.
Thank you guys for having me.
And I hope you'll come back. I'm sure, like, there will be other...
I don't know if there's going to be any more protests this year.
Yeah.
This
might not be relevant, you know, but...
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson-Bates, Burton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.va.tech.edu. Thanks for listening. Started the car, then I tried to leave. But something told me to keep it in park until I could see the reason why he was mad at a stranger, like I was supposed to save him, like I'm the reason he homeless and asking me for a favor. He's staring at me, his eyes follow me with no laser.